Well, years ago, I taught school for several years, and I got real used to telling kids to sit down, to not run in the halls, to tell them when they had to be quiet, to call on those who raised their hands and allow them to talk, and to tell some of the others to quit talking. And amazingly, it usually worked because I was the teacher. Later on, I became a substitute teacher, and that was a different story, because they knew that I had no say in their grades. And so getting them to do anything was difficult. Often they wouldn't even work while I was there because the work was not due at the end of the period. So I had no recourse, really, because they didn't have anything to do, so they could just sit there and talk. And what I learned was that your identity determines your authority. As the real teacher, I had great authority, but as the substitute teacher, I did not, and the kids knew it. As we move into this last section of the book of Luke, we're going to see that the rulers and the leaders of the Jewish people seem to be consumed with the issue of Jesus' authority. And we're going to see that that authority is related to Jesus' identity, just as my authority was related to who I was as the teacher. Basically, they come to him over and over and over and say, these are my words, this is the K paraphrase, who do you think you are? It's a question of his authority. Why do you have authority? Who do you think you are doing these things and saying these things? And this is what we have in our lesson. Now, we finally moved into the last section of Luke. If you remember, we started in chapter 1 and we went through chapter 4, verse 13, dealing with Jesus' early life and his preparation for ministry. And then in 4:14 all the way through 9:50, we look at Jesus' ministry in Galilee. And then, beginning in 9:51, Jesus turned his face toward Jerusalem, and we saw that this was a journey, not a straight line journey, physical journey, but it was a journey of destiny where he was set with his face toward the crucifixion and toward the end of his life. And then in 1927, we are now turning to the end of that journey, that he has made it to Jerusalem for the final week of his life where he will be crucified and then resurrected. So let's begin reading in Luke 19, verse 28. After Jesus had said this, he continued on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. Now when he approached Bethpage and Bethany at the place called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, telling them, go to the village ahead of you. When you enter it, you will find a colt tied there that has never been ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Just say, the Lord needs it. So those who were sent ahead found it exactly as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, why are you untying the colt? They replied, the Lord needs it. Then they brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and Jesus got on it. As he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. As he approached the road leading down from the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. But some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. He answered, I tell you, if they keep silent, the very stones will cry out. Here we see in verse 39 that some of the Pharisees wanted Jesus to rebuke the disciples. And this isn't just the 12, this is the whole crowd of disciples. These are hundreds of people there who are Jesus' followers. And they want him to rebuke him because basically they're saying, who does he think he is letting them honor him as king? And we see they were calling him the king back in verse 38. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. They were proclaiming him as the king, the Messiah, the son of David, who was going to come and deliver them. And I'm sure they expected physical deliverance from Rome because the king had finally come. But the Pharisees and the leaders are saying, who does he think he is? He should not be accepting this honor that they are giving him. But Jesus rebukes them. Rather than quieting the people, he says, if they keep silent, the very stones will cry out. He is saying, I am who they say I am. As the king, I am the king of the Jews, and as such, I have the right to the honor and the acclaim of my subjects. And if they don't give it to me, creation will, because I deserve this honor and I deserve this acclaim. And so from that point on, we're going to see more and more of them questioning him about this. Verse 41, now when Jesus approached and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, if you had only known on this day, even you, the things that make for peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and surround you and close you in on every side. They will demolish you, you and your children within your walls, and they will not leave within you one stone on top of another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation from God. Jesus prophesied here of the coming siege and destruction of Jerusalem that would happen in 70 AD. And he cries here over the city, over the people, over the destruction that's going to come. Who did Jesus think he was? He was the king. And as such, he loved his people. He loved his city. He cried over what was going to happen here. But see, he had the authority as king to determine the punishment for those who would not accept his authority. He says, you did not recognize the time of your visitation from God because you will not accept my authority as king. You did not recognize that I am God come in your midst. Then the punishment will come, and this will be the punishment. I will, as king, determine the punishment for your people. I think we're kind of behind with the slides here, ladies. I guess I just had them so engrossed with what I was saying. Anyway, just as the Old Testament prophets spoke oracles of doom to the people, this will happen to you if you don't repent, if you don't turn. So Jesus comes in as the king. He proclaims that there will be doom because they are not accepting his authority over them. He is the king, and he has the right to determine the punishment of those who will not accept his authority over them. Because as the king, he does have total authority to do that. In verse 45, then Jesus entered the temple courts and began to drive out those who were selling things there, saying to them, it is written, my house will be a house of prayer, but you have turned it into a den of robbers. Jesus was teaching daily in the temple courts. The chief priests and the experts in the law and the prominent leaders among the people were seeking to assassinate him, but they could not find a way to do it, for all the people hung on his words. When Jesus went into the temple, he used his authority to clean it out and to restore it to its original purpose, which was worship and prayer. Throughout the Old Testament, we see that the kings had authority over worship. They had authority over the temple. If you read through the books of history in the Old Testament, you would see that the Old Testament kings, the good ones, who were few and far between, came in and they would go into the places where people were worshiping idols, called the high places, and destroy them because they had authority to do that. And I want us to even look at King Josiah in 2 Kings 23 because we're going to see how the king had authority over the temple. 2 Kings 23, beginning in verse 4. The king, this is King Josiah, ordered Hilkiah the high priest, the high-ranking priest, and the guards to bring out of the Lord's temple all the items that were used in the worship of Baal, Asheroth, and all the stars of the sky. In other words, at this time, they were actually had brought the idol worship into God's very temple. And Josiah comes in and says, clean it out. Get rid of it. The king burned them outside of Jerusalem in the terraces of Kidron and carried their ashes to Bethel. He eliminated the pagan priests whom the kings of Judah had appointed to offer sacrifices on the high places and in the cities of Judah and in the area around Jerusalem. They offered sacrifices to Baal, the sun god, the moon god, the constellations, and all the stars in the sky. He removed the Asherah pole from the Lord's temple and took it outside Jerusalem to the Kidron Valley, where he burned it. He smashed it to dust and then threw the dust in the public graveyard. King Josiah went in and cleaned out his temple. Well, Jesus, as the king, had authority to clean out his temple, and that's what we see him doing here. But we also see that the leaders, this really upset him. They were already upset at him for accepting the acclaim and the honor of his subjects, but they were very upset that he took authority in the temple. And we see here in verse 47 that they decided they had to assassinate him. They had to get rid of him. They had to end this threat, this person who was coming in and taking authority that they felt like they had for themselves. But the problem was the people, on the other hand, were hanging on his words. They were listening to him. So they couldn't come where the people were around and take him away because the people were hanging on his words. So they were just trying to find some way to come against him and to assassinate him. So as we go on in chapter 20 now. Now one day as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts and proclaiming the gospel, the chief priests and the experts in the law with the elders came up and said to him, "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who is it that gave you this authority?" He answered them, "I'll also ask you a question and you answer me. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from people?" So they discussed it with one another, saying, "If we say from heaven, he'll say, 'Why did you not believe him?' But if we say from people, all the people will stone us because they're convinced John was a prophet." So they replied that they did not know where it came from. Then Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by whose authority I do these things." They were basically saying, "Who do you think you are to clean out the temple and to say these things with such authority? Where do you think you get this authority? Who do you think you are?" But the problem was they were caught between a rock and a hard place with Jesus' answer, because if they said, with the question he gave them, if they said John's authority came from heaven, they not only would validate John's ministry, but they would validate Jesus's, because remember, John said Jesus was the Messiah, he was the Son of God. So they couldn't do that. But if they said it came from people, the people would turn on him, and they were scared to death of the people. So Jesus put them in a situation where they did not give an answer. So Jesus did not answer them. "I'm not going to tell you who I think I am." But he goes on to tell them a parable in which he basically does answer their question. He just doesn't answer it outright. Beginning in verse 9, "Then he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, leased it to tenant farmers, and went on a journey for a long time. When harvest time came, he sent a slave to the tenants so they would give him his portion of the crop. However, the tenants beat the slave and sent him away empty-handed. So he sent another slave. They beat this one too, treated him outrageously, and sent him away empty-handed. So he sent still a third. They even wounded this one and threw him out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, 'What should I do? I will send my own dear son. Perhaps they will respect him.' But when the tenants saw him, they said to one another, 'This is the heir. Let's kill him so the inheritance will be ours.' So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others." When the people heard this, they said, "May this never happen." But Jesus looked straight at them and said, "Then what is the meaning of that which is written, 'The stone which the builders rejected became the cornerstone'? Everyone who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, and the one on whom it falls will be crushed." Then the experts in the law and the chief priests wanted to arrest him that very hour, because they realized he had told this parable against them, but they were afraid of the people. I call this the in-your-face allegory. I mean, they've just been questioning Jesus. Who do you think you are? And he comes back with this allegory. And you saw in your lesson that scholars would call this an allegory because there are so many points of correspondence between the allegory and reality. A parable will only have one or two things that are point to reality, whereas an allegory has many. This one is an allegory. All through the Old Testament, the picture of a vineyard is used for God's people, Israel. That was clear to them. They knew Jesus was talking about Israel. Then you've got the tenant farmers, who are the leaders to whom God had entrusted the care of his people. And yet they refused to bow the knee, basically, to the owner or to God. And so God kept sending prophet after prophet after prophet, and they refused to listen to the prophets, and many of them they even killed. And so eventually he sends the son and the heir, clearly Jesus. And it's interesting that Jesus says, and they killed him. They've just been planning to assassinate Jesus, and he's saying, I know exactly what your plan is. You think you have some secret plan to assassinate me? This is your plan. You plan to kill me. I am the heir. I am the king. I have the right to do this. I have authority because of who I am. You want to know who I think I am? I'm the heir. I am the king. I am the rightful owner. And we see here that at the end, The owner comes, he destroys the tenants, and he gives the vineyard to others, who would be the Gentiles. But we see here that as the king, he has the right to punish the traitors. These are traitors. They will not bow the knee to the king. They refuse to do what the king tells them to do. They refuse to give him what is rightfully his. So he, as the king, can punish the traitors as he determines. And that's what we see here. So, who does Jesus think he is? He thinks he's the king. He knows he's the king, and as the king, he has the right to rule. He has authority, and he has the right to punish those who do not bow the knee to him. He is the stone that they, as the builders, rejected, that God used to build his kingdom for his purposes. So no wonder they wanted to arrest him immediately. They knew he was talking about them, and they could see that he knew their plot and what they were planning to do. So it's interesting that they are saying, who do you think you are? And through the parable or the allegory, he's basically saying, who do you think you are? You're merely the tenant farmers. I'm the heir. Who are you to suggest that I have no authority? So he turns the tables and said, who do you think you are? You don't have authority here. You're not the owner of this land and of these people. God is, and you have no right here. So he turned the tables, and yet in their anger and their inability to trap him, they try then two different ways to trap him. They tried a political trap and then a theological trap. And so we see in chapter 20, beginning in verse 20, they watched him carefully and sent spies who pretended to be sincere. They wanted to take advantage of what he might say so that they could deliver him up to the authority and jurisdiction of the governor. Thus they ask him, Teacher, we know that you speak and teach correctly and show no partiality, but teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right for us to pay the tribute tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their deceit and said to them, Show me a denarius. Whose image and inscription are on it? They said, Caesar's. So he said to them, Then give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Thus they were unable in the presence of the people to trap him by his own words, and stunned by the answer, they fell silent. They must have believed they were putting Jesus in a dilemma from which he could not escape. If he said, Don't pay taxes, then he would be guilty of insurrection and they could get him that way. But if he said pay taxes, he would have angered the Jews. So they thought they had him. But Jesus, with his intelligence and his wisdom, knew exactly what to say to beat them. So then they tried the theological trap. Verse 27, Now some Sadducees who contend that there is no resurrection came to him. They asked him, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies leaving a wife but no children, that man must marry the widow and father children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first one married a woman and died without children. The second, then the third married her in the same way. All seven died leaving no children. Finally, the woman died too. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For all seven had married her. So Jesus said to them, The people of this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are regarded as worthy to share in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. In fact, they can no longer die because they are equal to angels and are sons of God, since they're sons of the resurrection. But even Moses revealed that the dead are raised in the passage about the bush, where he calls the Lord the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Now he is not God of the dead, but of the living, for all live before him. Then some of the experts in the law answered, "Teacher, you have spoken well." For they did not dare any longer to ask him anything. Jesus corrected them on two points concerning resurrection here. They were arguing that resurrection would cause all these marital problems. And he said that was an invalid argument because in the resurrection there is no marriage. And then their belief that there's no resurrection was false from Moses, from the writings of Moses. And these were the only writings that the Sadducees believed in. He used the very writings they believed in to show them that there is a resurrection, because when God said, "I am the God of Abraham," he didn't say, "I was the God of Abraham when he was here on earth. I am now the God of Abraham." That meant, from that present tense verb, that Abraham is still alive. I am the God of Abraham, I am the God of Isaac, and I am the God of Jacob. They are still alive, they have been resurrected, and I am still their God. Jesus outsmarted the opposition. In fact, if this were a game and they were keeping score, it would like be Jesus thousands and these other guys zero. Because over and over and over throughout this whole book, we have seen him defeat them over and over and over. And they finally realize that they cannot defeat him. They cannot trick him into a corner. And so they finally quit publicly questioning, "Who do you think you are?" and decide to go about it from other ways. But Jesus decides to tell him anyway who he is. He follows this in verse 41. "But he said to them, 'How is it that they say that the Christ is David's son? For David himself says in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. If David then calls him Lord, how can he be his son?'" Jesus is God. He is exalted to the heavens. And as God, he's greater than David. As man, he is a descendant of David. And so David, looking ahead to the birth of Jesus, looking ahead from the past, calls his descendant, who would be the Messiah, Lord, and says he is exalted, that God will put all his enemies under his feet. And the leaders have no answer to this. They cannot understand this. But he basically says, "You want to know who I am? You want to know where I get my authority? I am not only God of the Jews. I'm not only King of the Jews. I'm King of Heaven. I am the heavenly King as well as the earthly King. I am ruler of all creation as well as King David. Although he was my ancestor, I am his ruler. I rule over him. I am God himself." And you know, I don't think we really understand a king's authority, because we live in a democracy. And it's just hard for us to fathom what unlimited power is like. We don't understand that whatever the king says is done. I think the closest we can really think of this is the term dictator. The problem is that dictator has such a negative connotation because he's a ruthless person. Whereas Jesus is a all-powerful king who rules in justice and goodness and mercy. A dictator doesn't do those things, but the same kind of power that a dictator has at his disposal is exactly the same kind of power that this kind of king has. And it's just hard for us, I think, sometimes to realize how much authority Jesus is saying he has, because he is the king. So, who does Jesus think he is? He is the king. He is King of the Jews, and he is King of Heaven. And then if you turn over in chapter 21, verse 25, as he gives them some prophecies of the future, he says, "And there will be signs in the sun and moon and stars, and on the earth nations will be in distress, anxious over the roaring of the sea and the surging waves. People will be fainting from fear and from the expectation of what is coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man arriving in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to happen, stand up and raise your heads, because your redemption is drawing nigh." He says, "I'm not only the earthly Jewish king and the heavenly king, but I am the king who is going to come. And when I do, that's when your redemption is going to come. So you look forward to him coming and ruling as the king. Now, I thought about this lesson. I thought, what difference does it make for us today that Jesus is the king? Does it make any difference to us today? Is there any application from this? Well, the first application is that that means that because we are his subjects, we have entered his kingdom, that he has the authority to rule our lives. He has authority over us as his subjects, just as any king has authority over his subjects. He determines the rules for living in his kingdom, and he determines the consequences for not obeying the rules, just like any king would do. But too often, we sort of have that pharisaical attitude here. Something happens in our lives, and we ask God, who do you think you are to do that to me? Who do you think you are to tell me how to live? I want to live my own way. That's exactly what the Pharisees were doing with Jesus. That's exactly what the rulers were doing with him. Instead, our attitude should be, you are the king, and it is your right to rule over me as your subject. And I bow the knee. I don't always accept it, but I bow the knee and I say, Lord, I yield myself to you. Whatever you want to do in my life, you are the king and you have complete authority over me. Understanding that Jesus is king also means that he has the right and the authority to clean out his temple. And we know that today we are the temple of God. If you'll turn over to 1 Corinthians 3:16-17. Do you not know that you're God's temple and that God's spirit lives in you? If someone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, which is what you are. In the Old Testament, God inhabited a physical temple. And now that Jesus has come, we are his temple. His Holy Spirit inhabits us. And he has every right to use his temple as he pleases, just as he did then. The temple is for God's worship, and that is what our temple is for. Just as Jesus cleaned out the money changers to get rid of all the things in the temple that distracted from worship to him, that polluted the temple, that made it unholy, he will clean us out if we don't do some work to clean our own temple out. In Hebrews 12, if you want to turn to that, we see that God is in the business of working in our lives if we don't do something about it ourselves. Hebrews 12, beginning in verse 4. You have not resisted to the point of bloodshed in your struggle against sin, and have you forgotten the exhortation addressed to you as sons? My son, do not scorn the Lord's discipline or give up when he corrects you, for the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son he accepts. Endure your suffering as discipline. God is treating you as sons, for what son is there that a father does not discipline? But all sons have shared in, but if you do not experience discipline, something all sons have shared in, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Besides, we have experienced discipline from our early fathers and we respected them. Shall we not submit ourselves all more to the God of spirit and receive life? For they disciplined us for a little while as it seemed good to them, but he does so for our benefit that we may share his holiness. In other words, if we let all these things into our lives, just as they did in the temple, things that were distracting from the worship of God, God will come in and discipline us because he loves us. Jesus cleaned the temple out because he loved his people and he wanted them to be able to pray and worship there. God will clean out our temple so that all of us worships him, so that we are holy as he wants us to be. I took this last weekend off and I went down to the hill country to some friends' ranch and spent the weekend with them. And it was a lot of fun. But about a year ago at their ranch, their nephew Clay, who is also a co-owner of this ranch, went down there with two of his buddies and they were going to hunt. And when they walked up to the ranch house, one of them looked up at the house, and he saw some buzzards looking down at them from inside the windows. So they knew there was a possible problem here. So they made a plan, and they got some shovels, and they ran in and stormed the ranch, and they said, okay, fellas, the party's over. And sure enough, there were 25 to 30 buzzards in the house, and they were partying. They had packed most of the furniture up. The ceiling was torn up from them trying to fly in the room, and the other mess that they left behind we won't even discuss. But because Clay was the owner, he had the authority to go in and get rid of the buzzards. So they took their shovels, and the buzzards that they couldn't scare out, they hit with the shovel and dragged them out. And then they had to hire a cleaning company that specializes in disasters to come in and fix everything. What could be repaired was repaired, and everything else was basically thrown out. As Clay and his friends began to investigate what the problem was, they found a back door that was open. Now, at this ranch house, there are three entrances to the house. The front door and the side door, the door opens into a porch. And then there's a second door that gets you into the house. So these were very secure because you had to go through two doors to get inside the house. But at the back of the house was a door that just went straight into the house. And it didn't really close probably quite as well as some of the others. They'd been having some problems with it. 3 days before they found the buzzards, a storm had come through, and apparently the wind of this thunderstorm had blown the door open, and the buzzards came in and started having a great little party for the buzzards. But, you know, when the owner came, he was able to go in and restore the house to the purpose for which the house was there, which was for the owner's use, not for the use of the buzzards. And you know, we have been set aside for our owner's use. Jesus owns us as his children. And he has the right to come in and clean out when we are being used for other purposes. He has the right to come in and clean out his temple, just as Clay had the right to go in and clean out those buzzards. And you know, if we don't secure the doors to our thoughts, to our actions, a lot of times we start letting things in sort of unintentionally. Just small things. We're not really securing ourselves against things that would pollute us, against things that would be unholy. And, you know, as I thought about that, I thought about when I was first started staying home with my kids. You know, I'd watch some of those soap operas and talk shows during the day. But after a while, I began to realize that I was just letting some things into my mind that were not doing real well there. That I was beginning to really focus on myself and what I wanted. I was beginning to focus on my appearance and the shortcomings of my husband. You put all these together, and a disaster was in the making in my life. And so I determined that if I was going to shut and secure the door of my heart, I couldn't watch those things. So I just didn't turn on the TV during the day. Now, that may not be your problem. Perhaps it's what you read. Perhaps it's the books and magazines that you read. Perhaps it's romance novels that get you to thinking about things, how much better this person in the book is than your present husband. Perhaps you haven't secured your heart against some of the people, men that you work with, perhaps. Perhaps you're kind of enjoying flirting with them or talking to them in ways that you wish your husband would talk to you. You need to secure those doors and shut that so that that is not a possibility. You know, even your friends can cause a door to be not secure. I went down and visited my sister last summer and ate lunch with her and her friends, and by the time that hour and a half of lunch was over, I told my sister, I said, I don't know how you have these friends. They would drag me down. Everything they talked about was just clothes and looks and plastic surgery, or if they talked about other people, it was always negative, dragging them down, gossip kind of stuff. I can't be around that. That is not securing myself against the things that God would not have me thinking about. So whatever it is, we all need to think through what things are we sort of letting creep into our life that can eventually just sort of blow the door open and really cause destruction in our lives or distraction from the worship that we're to give to God. Jesus has the authority as king to deal with those things. And if you start letting them in and you don't deal with them, he will come in and deal with them. He will discipline us. Because he's the king and he has authority over us as his subjects. And he wants the best for us. He doesn't do this out of hatred or some sort of revenge. He does it because it's not in our best interest to let those things into our lives. So as we think about Jesus and who he thinks he is the king, and we need to bow the knee before him. And when things happen in our lives, we need to accept them as coming from a king who loves us and that we are his subjects. And we need to be ready to clean out those things in our lives that distract us from worshiping him or that could cause destruction and that keep this temple from being holy. Let's pray. Father, it really is an overwhelming thought to think about what it means to be a king and what authority that carries with it. I pray that we realize that you are our king and that we bow the knee and that we don't question you and say, who do you think you are to do these things to me? But that we realize that you are not only a king, but you're a wise king and you're a loving king and you're a benevolent king. And that we can trust you. Help us to have the faith that trusts you. And Father, I pray for all of us that if there are things in our lives that are possible areas of destruction, that we have not secured all entrances to our mind and to our heart, to things that would pollute us, that things that would cause us not to be holy, to things that would cause us not to bring honor and glory to you, that you will convict us of those things. You'll show us how we need to really secure all the entrances to who we are, that we may not end up having destruction in our lives and living with those consequences. I thank you for these ladies. I thank you for the perseverance they have shown in this study of Luke. We thank you for this book. We thank you that you had Dr. Luke write this down for us, and we thank you for the lessons that it has for us. In Jesus' name, amen.